This is Tales from Agnes, 1972 flooding in the Chemung Valley, presented by the Arts Council of the Southern Finger Lakes to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the 1972 flood. Episode 5, Ruin and Renewal. At the time Agnes hit the U.S., it was the costliest storm in the nation's history. Much of the damage came from the flooding in the Chemung River Valley, which ravaged the Twin Tiers area of New York and Pennsylvania. In this episode, we listen to testaments of this catastrophe's ruinous aftermath, as well as the courage and tenacity with which some communities faced the arduous task of rebuilding and renewal. It took years of concerted, stubborn effort to rebuild. Every member of the community did their part and has their tale to tell. This episode represents only a small fraction of these stories. Communications in 1972 were far more limited than they are today. For some, it would be days later, after the floodwaters had receded, that they would witness firsthand the true breadth of the storm's impact on their area. Scott Kirk recalls his first experience of the disaster, having been 8 years old and living high and away from the flood.
I remember once the floodwaters had receded, when we took a ride downtown to see the devastation, then I started to get a grasp of how devastating it was, because where we lived on the very north side of Corning, we couldn't really see much except that time that my mother walked us down to where the floodwaters had risen to. And I can remember looking down Baker Street, looking south on Baker Street from Spruce Street, and seeing a couple houses slid out into the road into Baker Street. But until we got a chance to ride downtown, like I said, then we could really see the devastation, and it didn't seem so fun to me by that time. I mean, it was fun seeing the military vehicles and helicopters flying all around and the fire trucks going here and there, but then when it really hit me when I seen the devastation.
Local schools and colleges were quickly converted into evacuation centers for displaced victims. Elmira College was one among many of these sites, but by itself it administered relief aid to around 8,000 or 9,000 people. It housed 4,000. Despite this enormous effort, the need was overwhelming. Those whose homes escaped the ravages of the flood became small refugee centers for neighbors, friends, and family. Gina Buckley and her family became one example among many of those who took a great part of this responsibility upon themselves.
My family took care of a whole lot of Big Flats residents. They came and slept under our tables and on our floors for weeks at a time because they couldn't get in their homes. I remember being sent up to my aunt's in Bath, New York, because we had so many townspeople laying on the floors and in the garage and the patio and in the house, and there wasn't room for me, and they had to use my room as well. So my grandmother and I finally had to go up a week after the flood and stay in Bath for a couple months because it was just so terribly, you know, we've lost so many things.
Community members helped in every way they could. Donna Crinolan went to great lengths to bring essentials back from New Hampshire. Later, she would be involved in the effort to distribute the food to those in need.
We went to New Hampshire to get food to bring back, Jesse and I. And they had a summer place up in Dublin where we took all of the children with a babysitter. And then we came back and we had a car loaded with, to be honest, it was booze in the trunk. And my whole car was loaded with Mr. Beamer's chickens, we called them, because this man up there had donated all these chickens for us to bring back. And then when we got in Elmira, of course, we had to get them helicoptered, half of them, over to Father Jones, who was the curate of Grace Episcopal Church, to cook for the south side of Elmira. And we cooked ours for this side of Elmira. And basically one of the food outlets was at Grace Episcopal Church. So it was just a combination of running and getting water, and a lot of the people were gouging us. And it was interesting at the time, but there are many, many stories and really too many to unfold.
As Corning and Elmira lay ravaged, without communication, there were those incredible individuals who brought support from the outside world. In an attempt to do everything they could for the suffering towns, Rita Kautz and her husband made a local collection of cleaning supplies from their hometown of Attica, New York, packed it into their Volkswagen bus, and headed for Corning to see what they could do. When they arrived, they were directed by the Salvation Army to a church that could use their supplies. She describes what they saw there.
Before we left the church, we kind of looked around a little bit, and the foundation of this church was made of huge blocks of quarried stone, which had just been absolutely displaced by the force of the current, which was amazing to us because they were so huge. Also, the pews in the church were in their, what you would expect to have, their regular order, neatly placed on the floor, but every one of them was covered with dried silt, except for one corner. Well, I couldn't quite figure that out, and I asked the pastor, why are all those corners exactly the same, and they're clean, they don't have any silt on them? He said, well, they all floated up to some certain depth, and then he showed me the water line in the church, and I couldn't believe it. So they were all floating up there, except for them being wooden. You know, one point of the pew would have some buoyancy to it, and it would be sticking out of the water and didn't get dirty. So the water slowly receded, and they went down to the floor, and then they put them back in place again with that clean corner. I thought that was amazing.
The implications of reestablishing the thriving valley communities were staggering to local officials whose job it was to spearhead the cleanup efforts. Some community members were linchpins in the sustained effort. In Horseheads, the mayor turned to Leola Schaefer, then Lee Almy, and her husband, the Reverend Don Almy, for support. Together, they headed up Operation Cleanup, the relief effort for the north side of Elmira.
Right after the flood, the mayor, Jack Barber of Horseheads, came to Don and me and asked us if we would head up a group that would be willing to do a couple of things. One, to collect needed materials to clean up and repair homes. And secondly, to set up what came to be called Operation Cleanup. And Operation Cleanup served as a cleaning and repairing organization for homes on the north side of the Chemung River. On the south side, Dr. Castor and his group were doing the same thing, but because people were not allowed to cross the river in the early stages, it was necessary to have someone on the north side also. And so we did that.
One of the hardest hit institutions in the flood was a local gem, the Corning Museum of Glass. Jane Spellman gives her insight on the enormous effort involved in cleaning it up.
The museum had 14 feet of water in its collection and was devastated, obviously, on June 23rd, 1972. But the community volunteered around it, and the museum employees, especially the library staff and the curatorial staff, were able to clean the galleries and clean the glass collection and fix the glass collection with the assistance of a number of other museums which volunteered staff and expertise. And this was very important to the Corning area.
With the help of employees and volunteers from both inside and outside the community, and under the influential leadership of Thomas Buechner, the Glass Museum was miraculously able to reopen 6 weeks after the flood hit. The process, however, involved endless hours of work. David Dowler, a newly employed Steuben glass designer, recalls the welcome embrace of a hot shower in the early days after the flood.
Everything was wet and nasty, and our job was to tear apart the display canvas, rip up the carpet, and kind of haul it out the front door of the museum and, you know, generally clean out the space. There was also a glass warehouse in the shop, and we had to take all the glass out of there and take it to another location. The thing was that in the early days after the flood, there was no running water in Corning, and so personal hygiene became kind of difficult from time to time. After working in the shop, Peter and I would go to his house up on the hill and kind of hose ourselves off with garden sprayers and things, and that didn't work too well. But at one point, we thought that, we heard that you could go out to the Caton School, which is 5 miles away. Go out to the Caton School where you could take a hot shower with soap and water and everything, and we thought, wow, this is a real breakthrough. This is going to be a wonderful thing. So after work one day, we opted my car and drove out to Keaton for this wonderful hot shower. The trouble was, it was an elementary school, and the showers hit us about waist height, but it was still really good.
Meanwhile, after having unloaded supplies at the church, Rita Kautz and her husband were given the name of an elderly couple in need of assistance. When they arrived, they encountered more than one surreal sight.
When we pulled up, we saw an elderly gentleman out in the yard with a garden hose, and he was the owner of the house. He never spoke to us, and I realized then he was, you know, mentally challenged at the time, apparently from shock because of the flood, and he was looking constantly at his garage, which was across the street in his neighbor's yard. And he stood there with a hose washing this mud from his own grass and lawn for the whole time that we were there, which was, you know, 5 hours, I would say, at least. So he was just not in good shape mentally because of this. I don't know how he'd been before that, but the daughter did explain to me that he was in shock. And this house had a chain-link fence around it, and an adjacent property up the street was a drugstore. And this drugstore had all of its contents removed by the river and deposited many of it on this gentleman's fence. So the whole yard was covered with supplies from a drugstore, from everything you could ever possibly imagine.
Eventually, Rita and her husband were able to help save an elderly couple's home from demolition. Seeming to follow their example, and in true altruistic form, much of the Northeast came together to help these communities rebuild. Bart Curtis, recently married, practically spent his honeymoon in the Elmira Corning area, helping where he could and investigating the situation in order to report back home to his radio station in Vermont.
My wife and I had been married just a week or so before the flood. I was working as an engineer at a radio station in Vermont. Management gave me some opportunity to take a honeymoon, so we spent our honeymoon cleaning up. My parents had a food service, and we distributed food to the lot of schools, et cetera, that were shelters for people that were displaced. And the day after the flood, my wife and I were down here in Elmira, walked across the railroad viaduct and up Main Street as I was using my press pass to see what was going on. And I phoned reports back to the radio station in Vermont. That was a condition that they said, you know, get out of here, but, you know, make sure we know what's going on.
In 1972, radio was one of the most important forms of communication in a disaster. There were no cell phones. There was no easy way for television stations to capture images of the devastation. The work done by local radio stations was monumental. Ruth Atkinson worked at WELM in Elmira, and when its transmissions flooded out, she became part of an emergency broadcast effort by WIQT-WQIX, which aimed to bring news of deaths, missing persons, and persons confirmed alive and well to the communities. Ruth estimates over 50,000 names at one point on the list of missing persons. Eventually, the project became too extensive, and it was handed over to the BOCES campus. Her tale takes place before this, while she was still volunteering at WIQT. Because of the lack of communication, a radio employee from Corning had to walk the 18 miles to and from Elmira to gather information from this communications headquarters.
One afternoon, a man came trudging into the studio at WIQT and said he needed some information. It turned out that of the two stations in Corning, WCBA and WCLI, they wanted to know if they could combine operations. One station had his studio up higher above the flood, but their transmission had been washed out. The other station had their studios in the flood area, but their transmission facilities were safe. They wanted to know if they could combine efforts to cover the Corning area. So I told them to go ahead and combine their efforts, and which they did. The man walked back the 15 to 18 miles to Corning because there was no transportation. And the result was that the two stations did go on the air.
Thanks to the leniency of FCC regulations, WCLI and WCBA were able to establish their own emergency broadcast channel. It was over this channel that Amory Houghton would soon deliver a definitive and legendary address to the people of Corning. In it, he would promise every single Corning Glassworks employee and retiree a zero-interest loan of $1,000 with no minimum term. With over 1,900 employees, in today's money, this amounts to $17 million. What follows is a short selection of this incredible speech. Every single person I have talked to has not only been full of sorrow, obviously great sorrow, but also full of determination. This, of course, is the underlying spirit upon which all hope for this community is based. It's not a tangible thing, it's much more. It's really a basic faith, and if there ever were a cement or a glue that can tie a people together, this is it. We are not licked. We are going to bounce back. And for many, we are going to start again. You know, I have heard rumors that because of the flood and its terrible toll, that the Corning Glassworks is going to move out of town. Nothing is further from the truth. The real heroes are the people of Corning. The wives, the kids, the teachers, the employees, not only of Corning Glassworks, but other businesses. The union, which pledged its full cooperation early in the disaster. The merchants and the volunteers. With all this concentration of help, the volunteers really are the key people. They ask nothing of themselves, other than to help where help is needed. And what can you say about people like this? Thank you just isn't enough. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been in a critical situation. We're coming out of it. We're going to win this battle against nature. And this is happening because of your united effort. The small annoyances vanish as we concentrate on rebuilding what has always symbolized the outstanding quality of life that we can aspire to. Many thanks, and good night. Tales from Agnes is produced by Trevor Worthy and Connie Sullivan Bloom in collaboration with the Arts Council of the Southern Finger Lakes. Special thanks to the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Community Foundation of Elmira Corning and the Finger Lakes, Caitlin O'Leary, and the dozens of community members who contributed their stories.